Welcome back to Too Much Future. I'm Cameron.
I'm Michael.
This is the show where we play through the Fallout games, and we also talk about them. This is episode 26. And last episode, we did some wasteland surviving.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you now know how to survive in the brutal wasteland that is the outdoors?
Unfortunately, yes.
Oh, wow. You feel like you could get irradiated real good and be able to do perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. That's confidence.
Yeah.
This episode, we're back to the main quest. You want to try to give us a 1 minute summary of the main quest so far?
We grew up in the vault. We had a whole childhood, a whole life. Very, very sort of filled out. Upon retrospect, compared to this, there's a kind of Nabokovian thing going on here, right? This is Ada or Arger, where each chapter mirrors like the sort of like depth of life, but sort of like in reverse, in the sense that like in Nabokov, everything in the youth is very like long and sort of epic and emotionally dense, and then the chapters get progressively shorter as the characters age. Here, everything was very short at the beginning, but felt like it promised so much more than I feel like existing in the world of Fallout has, even though the time has gotten substantially longer. So
it takes longer to do less stuff, is what you're saying.
Yes. Huh. Interesting. So anyway, the main quest, we had our whole childhood, all of that, and then we left the vault because our dad left the vault. We went to the town next to the vault to say, hey, where's our dad? And they said, well, he went off to see this guy on the radio. So we went to see the guy on the radio and said, hey, where's our dad? Did I do this right? Do we go to Three Dog next?
Yeah.
Yeah. Three Dog was like, hey, your dad's been through here, but you need to help me fix a problem first. And you say, okay, and you fix the problem. And then he's like, all right, your dad went to Rivet City. So we go to Rivet City and we're like, hey, where's our dad? And they say, well, your dad just came through here. He's at the Jefferson Memorial, which is where there's Project Purity, which is the thing that he worked on when he was a scientist in the outside world before smuggling you into the vault after the death of your mother during your birth. All of that, you know, emotionally dense stuff. Again, in the past, that's when that all happened. a long time ago. Right now, we're just kiting around after Dad. So, yeah, then we headed off to the Jefferson Memorial, which was the former headquarters of Project Purity. And that brings us to now.
Yeah, it's almost as if, you know, your father is some sort of emotional ranger or perhaps a warlock and is pelting you with emotional arrows and traps he's laid for you as you progress through the world, being kited, as you say, through all the difficulty.
Mm-hmm.
It would be cool if your dad was trying to kill you the whole time and like has been doing all these things to like lead you through ruin.
That's Hamlet.
Hamlet's papa, the ultimate warlock. He has a spirit form.
Yeah.
and a physical form. Okay, well, yeah, that's where we are. So I think the last time that we recorded for that last episode, I had not gone to Project Purity, but you had.
Yeah, I walked by it on my way to Rivet City.
Yeah, that's what's actually kind of interesting about that is I guess you could like really beef this up just by going in the thing.
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah, I had not completed that quest at that point. So yeah, very beginning of this recording session, Dr. Lynn is her name.
I don't remember now.
I think it is. I believe that's her name. She says, hey, yeah, he's over in Project Purity, over in the Jefferson Memorial. Yeah, you know that place with all those pipes. He's there. you go in there, it's full of super mutants. So I gotta hit them all with a hammer. Uh-huh. And I get in there, and it's like, hey, my papa's not here. Your yep. papa's in another castle. You know, this game is a lot like Mario.
Yeah.
That's all. That's all I have to say about
yeah.
it.
Yeah, no, I can see it, right? I can see it. Like, in the sense that there are maps.
Mm-hmm.
And there is... So the thought that I had before we started recording was that mm-hmm. for such a surprisingly broad world, there is so surprisingly little, or maybe not surprisingly, right? But for such a big world, there's so very little to do, right? There are truly so few verbs that you have. Mm-hmm. In terms of how you can interact with the world. And you really start to feel it here. But I understand that, right? I can see the Mario comparison there. If Mario didn't sort of like constantly iterate and elaborate at its best.
Mm-hmm. Well, and your papa is always in another castle.
Yes.
That is something, you know, something we've talked about already in the show for Fallout 3 has been like, well, it's interesting that sometimes your skills show up and they matter. And in the stuff that we did for this episode and the next episode, which we will be recording next, what's interesting about that is that, yeah, those skills really don't matter very much. And they matter, I think, even less than in Fallout 1 and 2, which, you know, I think that's something interesting, I guess, about the kind of comparisons that we've been making between, like, the... nostalgic past, right, for Fallout 1 and 2, and then Fallout 3, right, and how mm-hmm. that kind of coheres narratively and thematically, and how we've, you know, maybe been surprised that the cultural narrative around Fallout 1 and 2 was, wow, look at all this big weirdness versus, like, the smallness of Fallout 3, and we've been pretty side-eye about that. You know, we have not bought into that, but I'm thinking here at the middle of the a Fallout 3, there might be something to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because even with the kind of very finite amount of stuff you can do in Fallout 1 and 2, it's still, in terms of verbs, like you just said, in terms of ways to interact with this world, any given town kind of has more things to do in it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as like stuff you can be doing to people or with objects in the world than in Fallout 3.
Yeah.
Hmm. Because like I guess I can go into people's rooms and like steal their junk.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of it. I don't know.
Yeah, no,
it's interesting.
It's strange. The other way I thought about this is like the game kind of just plateaus, right? Everything mm-hmm. is kind of just there, and yeah, you either go or you don't.
Well, that's what's interesting about it too is that it like I don't know, like mechanically plateaus or something. There is a sameness to like the things you're doing. But I think in this episode, what we're going to maybe talk about a little bit is that there's some pretty cool narrative development here. And, or I think so. Maybe you don't think that.
Mm-hmm.
We'll figure that out. But what is interesting to me, I guess, is that the Fallout 1 and 2 are largely narratively and thematically incoherent.
Mm-hmm.
But mechanically, pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm.
If only because you had to spend like 40 hours of your life in turn-based combat.
Right.
Fallout 3, thematically, narratively, extremely coherent.
Mm-hmm.
And then just really limited in what you can do of anything outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Kind of a super stability going on here. But what'd you find out about Gerald Papa in Project Purity here in the Jefferson Memorial?
Well, he's come there. Trying to figure out, so, up front, like, I'll talk about what I find interesting here, or mm-hmm. sort of, you know, it struck me as like, oh, that's a thing that I noticed, because I remember way back at the beginning, when Eleanor broke into the Overseer's room when we were escaping the vault, one of the things I found on his computer were some notes from, this character Stanislaus Braun, who was some bigwig at Vault Tech, like the lead scientist and architect of the Vault experiments, and also kind of someone behind the development of the Gek. And one of the reasons I took notice of that was because it confirmed that the Gek was a kind of like gee whiz science fiction-y, like impossible optimistic kind of thing. Like a sort of retro-futuristic gag, right? Like, of course, this like wacky 1950s retro-future world created sort of like 1950s style, like just incoherent, impossible technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And this had been a debate in the Fallout fandom. It had come up when we read the Fallout Bible, where people were like debating, is this like wacky future technology, or is it something more practical, like a handbook or an archive or something like that? And Chris Avalon in that said as canon that it was something more realistic, right? It was basically a bunch of like starter seeds for various crops or something like that. And then this game went right back off that. Into the wacky technology thing. So that was like one big kind of shift in continuity that I noticed. Then here we get a kind of follow through on that, which is that your dad needs to find something from Stanislaus Braun, because he would have known something about the Gek. And it turns out Stanislaus Braun is in another vault, Vault 112. All of the stuff that I just told you is like far more interesting and sort of more in depth than the time I actually spent in the Jefferson Memorial, which was listening to various audio logs that your dad leaves behind, where he kind of just explains all of this once, but like from various directions. So you're always just learning the same piece of information, or sort of, you know, if you put them in order, there is a kind of like development. There's no real depth to it. And there's also one where he's like super kind of weird because it's your mom's audio log and she's trying to record, and he keeps like trying to like flirt with her, and we get the sense initiate sex with her.
Ooh.
So I
don't think I listened to that one.
This is all stuff like Eleanor found. This was a real trying time for Eleanor.
I didn't get that one. I did get the one though where he's like, I've been living in the vault, and one night after I had some whiskey, I broke into the overseer's, you know, thing, is the overseer's computer, and I did all this stuff. And like, I'm just getting like this mental image of Liam Neeson being like, I have a particular set of skills. It's getting drunk and breaking into computers from the 1950s. It's getting drunk and going into the retro future. but but you're right. Like, it's this weird, like quadruple or triple repetition, so you don't miss anything. Uh-huh. You know, whenever this kind of thing shows up in the narrative of a video game, I'm always... You know, I got a certain amount of respect for narrative designers and writers in this scenario, because they are having to write a bunch of redundant information in order to make sure both that you get it in a general sense, and also if you only get part of this thing, you'll still understand what you're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I don't envy them of like the job here, but I think they do a pretty good job of you know, giving it to you from a bunch of different angles. The other part of this being kind of that retro future thing and retro future, in case you haven't listened to the other episodes, or you've heard it and we haven't really explained it, then retro future is just the future of the past, right? So you pick a time period and then you project forward kind of future from that moment. So this is the future imagination in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think is interesting about that here is that this is very much that this, you know, doctor who is creating the super technology, right? This is a reference to, you know, the Nazi scientists. Was it Project Paperclip? Was the thing where all the Nazi rocket scientists were brought to the United States and then put into employ in the space program?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Stanislaus Braun, right, or von Braun, is Wernher von Braun.
Yeah,
and that's a real dude.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to me that like this retro future figure is like a pseudo figure, you know, it's the Fallout world version of this guy. And instead of going to space, they were trying to survive nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we got.
Mm-hmm.
So you went to Vault 112.
Yep. The enemies have started, I don't know what level, what level is Tonk?
Level 10, maybe? I think during this episode, he crossed over into level 10, I believe.
Wow. Okay.
What level are you?
So I think, possibly during, No, it's going to be during, I think, probably the next episode we record. So I'm like level 14, I think, right now.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm going to level up, I think, next episode. I'll talk more about that then. The most that I sort of was noticing was that sort of enemies that were appearing around me had like mm-hmm. just it's that weird kind of Bethesda thing where you're just like, oh, I hit some point in the level scaling and now like things are going to be slightly more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But like in the sense I was just like, oh, there's a Yagwai, right? Which are these new enemy monsters. They're like giant mutated bears.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of this game's version of death claws, or like sort of pre-death claws, because like there are death claws later.
Yeah, it's like a half death. It's like this version's or this game's version of the fire gecko.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Like in the hierarchy of, you know, enemy fights.
Yeah. So it was just, that was a thing that I noticed. I was like, oh, there's a Yagwai. And then like, at one point I encountered like a rope, like a big, like military robot sentry thing that blew me up with a rocket.
Mm.
And I was like, dang. But anyway, so I get to, Vault 112, which is, hidden under a gas station out in the wasteland. Get there. You know, you dig around, there's some stuff. You find a switch in the garage that opens the secret entrance to the vault. You go down, you go in. And I remember being very impressed by all of what ensued here in 2008. I remember really, really liking all of this.
We now interrupt this radio broadcast.
Hi, everyone. My name is Hypo, and it's time for The Skeleton Tidbit. I'm of the mind that Fallout 3 has a pretty strong opening. It puts you in a time and place, gives you a personal history, and lets you spend just enough time there to feel situated before it's all yanked away. You're thrust out of your relatively comfortable vault life and into one that's totally alien to you. The change is immediate. Before you even leave the vault proper, right after you open the enormous vault door, you must confront two very sad skeletons. They carry picket signs demanding that they be let into the vault. They read, "We're dying, assholes. Help us." These are our sad skeletons for the week. Who were these people that met their end of days here? Were they the friends and neighbors of the new vault residents, hoping to find mercy or refuge as their homes in Springvale burned? How must they have felt knowing that the residents are looking down at them through that security camera, watching them protest as the heat and radiation begins to take its first victims? I know I was deeply affected when I first encountered these skeletons back when I first played this. As I fled the only home I had ever known, guards shouting just over my shoulder, I stepped on these undisturbed skeletons. I couldn't afford to linger long, but I couldn't help but spend a moment thinking about who these people were. Why were they left here? What sort of world was I fleeing to? At the end of the world, this was far from the only protest going on. There were mass movements all across the country, protesting all sorts of human rights violations and failures of the state in the months leading up. Chrysalis was an auto manufacturer corporation that had to contend with some kind of protest of its own, or something. The two toilet skeletons for this week can be found on the top floor of the Chrysalis building. In one of the bathrooms, there's two very unhappy occupants, and they demand to be heard. Two garden gnomes are here, on the toilets, being very upset. They hold up picket signs that read, "We're dying assholes!" and "Help us!" And it's something, all right. Yep, here they are, having a protest. Well, thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Skeleton Tidbit. Off I go!
And not so much this time around, but we'll, I guess, talk a bit about sort of the whys of that. In Vault 112, it is another social experiment, but not social experiments like you've kind of been led to believe how they were structured. Because in Vault 112, there are only these attendant brain bots who tell you that you're like 200 years past due, right? You're 200 years late or something. Here, put on your jumpsuit and go get in the pod. And it says it much more, you know, welcomingly than that. But that's what greets you. And you go down and everyone is in virtual reality chambers, essentially. And it's, you know, creepy. And there's evidence that your dad has just come in. You can go around and, like, look at everyone's monitors. And you get some, like, names and some sinister information that their, like, heart rate or something. For most of them, it's elevated.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah. But you have no other choice but to get in the pod.
Mm-hmm. Much like, what's his face had to get in the pod? That anime guy. You know what I'm talking about?
I'm not sure.
The Evangelion, didn't he have to get in that pod?
He does get in the pod, yes. Most people say get in the robot is...
Oh, yeah. Is he getting that robot?
Shinji, right? He does get in the robot, which does mean he does get in the pod.
Mm-hmm.
Which is called a plug, actually.
Well, okay.
But...
You want to just talk about that? but yeah, so we like hop in this VR space, which is like not the kind of VR space you want it to be, right?
No.
So it's like not a headset or anything cool like that. It is literally a monitor that is just jammed into your face.
Yes.
And I will say, you know, you were talking about remembering or thinking when this game came back about how cool it was. I'm gonna say, you know, maybe not this whole section, but the visual image of like going down below this garage and going into the room where you look out the window and you see all the pods in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that still looks really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I like think that I guess it's pacing is the best word for it, but like the pacing of like you go to a vault entrance, it opens, you think, oh, it's going to be vault stuff in here. And you go in and it's not vault stuff, right? There's not human beings running around. It's just machines. And then you see like this pod structure. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, if you don't know about that, I think that maybe is why you have good memories of it. And I do too, right? It's like, no one told me that beforehand. I just figured this out.
Right.
And when I saw it the first time, I was like, oh shit, this is like a different kind of vault, you know? And so I think what do you call it? Like turning your expectations, right? Setting up one expectation with all this other vault stuff and then giving us a different thing. I think that works. I think that still works today. Because I didn't remember what it looked like. And so when I did this the other day to play it, I was like, oh, damn, this is like where it's at. Mm-hmm. But the piece that we're about to talk about does not work for me, which is you go into the VR space and you're in a place called Tranquility Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, what's there, Michael?
So it is a pre-war 1950s cul-de-sac, in black and white, sort of the Pleasantville school of this is what 1950s TV looked like, right? Leave it to Beaver or something like that.
Yeah. Pleasantville.
Mm-hmm. Sort of aesthetic of that is still there, right? There's this nice, like there's a annoying music that's playing in the background and everyone's just kind of like, oh, hi, you know, sport, slugger, whatever, as you're walking around. And tonally, just like sort of what you just described, like coming up to this, it's just the right kind of swerve where it takes this thing where you're like, I'm expecting one thing. It gives me something else. But then, as a consequence of giving me something else, it gives me something that I'm really interested in seeing, which is how did this sort of place, right? How did this society see itself? If this is like the 1950s sort of sitcom kind of thing, or mm-hmm. even if it's a fantasy of what life was like, I expect to see some of that. But mostly it's kind of very surface level, just interacting with people. And eventually you can get told that you should go talk to Betty, who is this girl in the center of the cul-de-sac. And obviously, right, by this point, you know something is wrong, because there's just no way that this can be maintained, whatever this is, whatever is going on. And there are other sources of discomfort, right? There's like this weird abandoned house, and there's an old lady who may talk to you. But how it happened for me is I went around, and everyone was eventually like, okay, go talk to Betty. So I did. And she is this little girl who wants you. She's very sinister, kind of creepy looking, has like very deep set eyes. And she tells you that she wants to play a game with you. She wants you to make
this... Would you like to play a game?
Yeah. She wants you to make this little boy, whom you've probably met by now if you're Eleanor. She wants to make this little boy cry. And so just go do that. Just go do that and you can learn some more stuff. Because all your options in terms of how to interact with these people in speech is just like, "Buh? What the heck is going on here?" Or, "I'm looking for my father. Have you seen him?" Or, mm-hmm. "You're all crazy. None of this is real."
Yeah, it's giving you a real cool thing and then not doing a lot with it.
Mm-hmm.
Just in general, like in every, I know that you're saying that, but like, I'm really trying to, you know, like in every respect, right? Like narratively, conceptually, you know, as you're saying, there's this great opportunity to like show us the ideology of this society. And really what it's giving us is like weird stereotypes about our own kind of history. Interestingly enough, there's no like nuclear stuff involved as far mm-hmm. as I saw, right? So it's like, what if it were Leave It to Beaver in this nuclear obsessed society in which they never talked about the thing that they're actually obsessed with, which seems very off
yeah.
in a general sense. And so, well, did you make that little kid cry? Did you go beat him up?
Well, at this point, Eleanor, she's got it together enough. She knows that this is wrong. Something's going on here. In that abandoned house, there are some strange objects that really caught Eleanor's attention because, of course, Eleanor, being a perceptive individual, you know, learning powers of ratiocination from her father in the vault,
mm-hmm.
she notices that in this barren, barren world where there are so few options in terms of what you can do, there are these just things sitting in the living room that you can interact with. And when you do, it makes a weird little sound. And that weird little sound is part of, like, you can make, like, a little musical reference or something. Like, a little like, musical measure out of... It's mm-hmm. like a little puzzle, right? You're a gamer. Put on your...
Little set of toots.
Yes. Yeah, put on your gamer theory glasses. See it for mm-hmm. what it is. It is mm-hmm. a little tone puzzle.
Well, that's just a theory.
So I try to solve this, and I can't figure it out, and I realize it's because I think maybe it's because I've already talked to Betty. So yes, that's all to say, like, I immediately was just like, oh, screw this, but I didn't know if I had to finish the quest I was technically already on, because that's how it comes up. It's a quest. Mm. If you go into that boy's house, his parents have a brochure for a military school on their table. And Eleanor just, like, walked right past him as he was sitting on the couch, grabbed the brochure, turned around, walked back, like, walked up to him on the couch, and said, "Hey, your parents are going to send you to military school, just FYI," right? Taking the, like, middlest, most even-handed option. And he was like, "What? What? No!" And then he cried. And then I went back and told Betty that I had made him cry, and she was like, "Great, now do something else for me." And I don't even know what it was, because by this point, Eleanor was just like, "Ugh, I'm not going to be a party to this. I already know how to get out of here." She just, like, said, "No, I won't do this anymore." And then, actually kind of cool, to its credit, Betty lets you, like, just stop talking to her for a while. And, like, you don't stay locked into this. You actually have to go reinitiate with her.
Hmm. Like, oh, if you want to come back and do this and take this seriously, you can. I did kind of a, I don't know, roundabout way of doing this. So I, you know, she says, go make Timmy cry. So I just pulled out my old fisticuffs and started wailing on this kid. Like, immediately. I got negative karma for it. So apparently you can't just beat up teenagers. Like, you should be able to in a video
game.
Oh,
I also got negative karma for telling him that he was going to military school, so.
Karma. You right. God from nowhere. Get down here, you coward, and fight me.
I mean, technically it is, right? Like, we're in a simulation.
Oh, that's true, I guess. A simulation of a simulation. Uh-huh. But yeah, so I did that, and then I got the next quest, which was, like, make two people get a divorce. And so I just went into their house and started rooting around, like you were talking about doing, and old lady, what's her name? Old lady Dithers shows up.
Mm-hmm.
While I'm in these people's house, and she's like, hey, that abandoned house over there, there's a terminal in there, and we are being kept hostage, and you need to figure it out. She's like, that's where the failsafe is. And I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, you know, the failsafe. So I roll over there, and I encounter these tooting objects, this farting, gnome, and this harmonizing beer mug. And all this kind of stuff. And I sat there and I used my straight up gamer brain to brute force that thing. And just hammered through it. Here's the thing that probably tripped you up. One of them requires a reuse.
Yep.
Yep. And so, but I did it. I like wrote it out on a sheet of paper. And I got the first one and I got the second one. And then I just used every single option, including the thing itself, for the rest of them, and brute force the puzzle all the way down to reveal the transmission thing to the failsafe. So I have no idea what else happened. And annoyingly enough, you might be thinking, dear viewer, listener, hey, that's against the spirit of the thing. That's what you sound like, by the way, viewer listeners. But that's against the spirit of the thing. You're doing it all wrong. You shouldn't have done it that way. And let me tell you, way back when this game came out, I did it the exact same way.
Yep.
Because old lady Dithers told me that was the only way out. Why would I keep talking to this girl who's ordering me around and speaking in a thick German accent? When her voice is messed up, why would I do that when I could be breaking the simulation? I'm Neo, okay?
Uh-huh.
I'm not Agent Smith. I'm not, Cypher trying to get back into talking about the meat being good. It tastes good. Don't let me tell you about it. Oh, I got to go be on The Sopranos. I got to play, this jackass with the horses and whatnot on The Sopranos. That's not me. I'm not doing that. I'm Neo. And so I summoned up the thing, you know.
Yeah, and I also encountered old lady Dithers, too. Actually, I am fairly certain I encountered her, like, the first time I stepped out after attempting everything and getting tripped up. Because I was like, I'm just not solving this right now. It's clearly some... My clue was that it's something in the background. Like, it's like the background music. Some part of the background music had to be a clue because it is so short and so repetitive. And so I eventually, like, trying to model that out, got the, what you said, the reverse, right? That you have to double use one. But yeah, the first time that I stepped out, I encountered old lady Dithers, who told me about the failsafe computer. And then I was like, all right, cool. Turned around, went back in, finished it. Because there are other things you can do here. I know this, not because I've ever done any of them, it turns out, I think, but because I have read about them. Because I have the same memory as you of being like, no, like, my character, like, in 2008 is just gonna, like, I'm gonna break the simulation and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm hacking the Gibson.
Right. And it turns out that is just, like, its own entirely sort of separate path. It doesn't sort of give you any hints as to what the other paths are.
Hmm.
Which I know include, like, a sort of, like, escalating series of, like, kinds of mischief you can do up until the point that you're, like, causing death and destruction. And I think, like, you have to become, like, a little Michael Myers slasher from the first 8 minutes of Halloween.
Well, that's interesting, I guess.
Yeah, which is interesting. But weirdly enough, like, the what you think might result in sort of the weirdest stuff happening, which is hacking the simulation, is just like reading some little text logs where you find out that this is being run by Stanislaus Brown, who is the guy you're here, you're after, that your father was after, your papa, whom you have not seen, by the way.
He's not in here, right, as far as we know.
Mysteriously. But anyway, Braun is in control here, and he's just like been locked away with all of these people in virtual reality and just like replaying the simulation over and over again and like getting them killed. And then you can like, so you can read sort of like some very short brief text entries about this, and then you can summon some Chinese soldiers to kill everyone.
Yeah.
Which is the thing. So,
oh, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, it's like, and the thing that is sort of interesting about that, right, is I think that lands differently if you've done the other routes, right? Or there's a potential for that.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. Because like what we get in the thing that we read, right? We find out, you know, he's done a bunch of other simulations before, and this is like the third like godlike simulation that Brown has done. Mm-hmm. And that there's this Chinese soldier mod that's been hacked into the system that's like a military preparation program, you know, to fight against the communists or whatever. Mm-hmm. And basically Brown has removed the inhibitors. Basically it's Matrix rules, right? For normally in the system, if you die in the game, you don't die in real life. However, he has removed it from everyone else. So if they die in the game, they die in real life. Mm-hmm. Except for himself. And so his worry is that if he kills everyone in the system, then he will have to live there forever alone. And because he can't unplug himself, basically. And so you summon the Chinese soldiers and they murder everyone in the world, but they can't murder Von Braun. And then I left him there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there are things that I think I can see how they would have landed differently with me in 2008 when I felt like there was more kind of here, right? I did feel like this gave me maybe not a depth of stuff, but it was like the novelty of it, right, was mm-hmm. enough yes. for me to be like, oh, cool. Because like he does a master thing, right, where he'll suddenly like he's this little girl and then he'll start talking in the voice of an elderly German man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's some like disturbing stuff here. Like, so I summoned up the you know the Chinese soldiers and I walked out, and as soon as I walked out, they just shot the head off of one of the people who were there. And by the way, just in case you're wondering, all these people want to die.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be killed. Because they're tired of living in this hell space. I mean, what's interesting, I guess, too, is that this is obviously there's a lot of Matrix in it. You know, all of these kind of concepts that we're talking about have a lot of Matrix-y kind of ness to them, and especially for the time period. But it's also Ubik from Philip K. Dick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's these people who are all trapped in a half-life, and they are being controlled by someone who's also in a half-life, but who has more power in it than they do. And so, you know, Brown is ruining their lives over and over again and then just resetting the simulation without killing them.
Well, mm-hmm. I'm
glad you did. So it's like, you know, this whole section, I think you're right about the novelty, because at that time, I didn't really... I think that the best, like, quote-unquote gamer content, right, in a broad sense, or at least this is a, I think, a way that lots of games work, is that you take something that people feel familiar with and then you gamify it, right? You like remediate it into the game space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is like really smart about remediating these like concerns about plugged inness and matrixy kind of problems. Are you part of the machine? Are you not? All that kind of stuff. Remediating that within the Fallout 3 averse, right? Mm-hmm. But I think in order to do that, you end up sacrificing a lot of like the cool specificity of the Fallout universe. And so it's really unfortunate to me that I think this is a cool section, but the ceiling on how cool it could be is so much higher than where it actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, what happened when you got out?
I mean, One note, actually. A cute little gag, something that's nice, is that when you try to check your Pip-Boy, you hold up your arm, and you've just got, like, a little child's wristwatch with, like a Mickey Mouse arm situation, but with the Vault-Tec boy.
Well, that's cool. Right? I didn't even try, I don't think, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's nice, right? That's cute, right? And, like, you know, sort of follows through. It follows through in a way that is, like, both logical and pleasant and nice. You're like, yes, that is what this would be like. So anyway, yeah, no, you get out of the simulation and your dad is just like sort of hopping around. these character models just do not look sort of right. Like human character models in movement do not always look right in this game this many years on. And he's like, oh, thank God you got me out. You know, this is great. I thought I'd be trapped there forever. Because it turned out he had been a dog who was next to Betty the whole time.
Yeah.
So you could talk to the dog, and you could be, you know, mean, good, or neutral to the dog. And then it turns out it was your dad the entire time. And he's like, thank you for getting me out. I'm going to go to Rivet City. You can come with me right now, or I'll be there later, whenever mm-hmm. you're ready.
What did you do?
I accidentally... told him to stay with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then, nevertheless, he, like, went out and ran away.
So, I manually walked with Papa Neeson from that garage all the way to Rivet City. It took 30 minutes.
Oh my god.
Because I thought, well, let's just see what happens, right? Like, I wasn't super excited about the Tranquility Lane stuff. It was a little bit of a bummer for me, and I thought, well, what could happen if I traveled with an invincible man across the wasteland? And, you know, he, as everyone knows, a Neeson does not travel as the crow flies, you know? It takes paths that are designed by a human's hand.
Uh-huh.
And so we have to walk along the roads, which takes way longer than just beelining it straight for the thing. He rolled out of that garage and immediately ran away. Runs the opposite direction of where we're going.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, well, I wonder what's going on with that. He runs to a tent and then comes back with a laser rifle. And then starts just shooting a herd of Brahmin that are, like, down the road. Just obliterating these things. And then it just keeps happening from there. So anytime you are in combat range of anything, he destroys it. And he'll say things, like, I wrote it down. He's like, it's like bloat flies are shooting at him. And he, like, you know, he'll run out of ammo for things, right? So he's got his laser rifle, and he's pew, 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 and he's shooting, and it goes away. And he's down to fisticuffs, and he's like, if that's the way it has to be, then. And he's just, like, running at this bloat fly. And he has no discrimination about what he fights, right? So we're like, okay, it's like Brahmin, whatever. Bloat flies, whatever. Super mutants with a minigun? Your dad goes for it. There was a section. we went through a part of like DC that I had not been through so far in this game. We had to like cross over a bridge to get in the city proper on the side where Rivet City is. There is a sky bridge over the road. In that sky bridge, there was like a super mutant brute, you know, like the mid tier with a minigun. Okay. And it starts like, you know, shooting us. He runs and just runs straight past them, okay? And I'm, like, kind of following along. I tried to throw some grenades in vats, and they, like, don't work. So I come out of vats, and the last image I see of Papa Neeson is him just making a left turn, boop, around the street. And so I run into the block, you know, to the end of the block, and I look up these stairs. He is nowhere to be found. He's gone. Completely gone.
Oh, wow.
Then I look back up to that sky bridge, and there is just, like, obvious combat happening. I'm seeing bullets flying around. I can hear it happening, all this kind of stuff. So I think, oh, yeah, I'll just give it a minute, and then he'll come back, you know?
Uh-huh.
So I'm, like, hanging out here, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting, and I probably wait like 4 or 5 minutes, and he never comes back. So I'm like, all right, I guess I have to like go through this whole sub dungeon to go find my dad, who was like fighting super mutants somewhere else in the world. So I like go through this building. There's no super mutants on the way. I make my way to that sky bridge, and he's there with a minigun in his hand. And so then, oh, this isn't it. This isn't even it. This is like, it's going to blow your mind. So then we like, we go and we're like back on our way. We're on the road. There's another super mutant with a minigun. So Papa Neeson pops his out and is just firing a minigun indiscriminately into like, this building where this super mutant is. We got to go kill it. So, you know, I save. We keep going. We end up getting to a raider camp. The raider camp, there's like raiders with missile launchers and they're firing missiles at us. I have a really great moment in my footage where I'm standing beside my dad and we both get hit by a missile and he flies through the air cartwheeling and lands on the other side of a fence. And I like have no idea where he went. So we end up going into this raider camp and there's like two entrances. It's like above the road a little bit. The road is sunken. It's above the road. There's two entrances, one over a bridge with like a turret on it, and then I don't know where the other one is. Papa Neeson goes for the other one where I can't see where he goes, but I go for the one that I can, so I figure, oh, we're going to meet in the middle. Mm-hmm. At this point, he's got, I think, the minigun, so I assume he's okay. So I like shoot a raider, I like get rid of a turret, I make my way through this camp, there's all kinds of junk everywhere, all this stuff, and I get in to see him with a power fist on his hand, just punching the shit out of all these enemies, getting shot with a missile launcher, just not giving a shit about it, just punching the hell out of people. So, like, that's the journey that I took with Papa Neeson across the wasteland. It took 30 minutes just to manually walk the whole way, beating the shit out of literally everything in my way.
Truly, truly the father of Tonk.
He's, you know, I was like, I get it now, you know. but so I would say this is a wild curveball for y'all. But if you do this mission, it is worth the price of entry to do this part of it, because it is kind of wild to see like basically an unkillable NPC, you know, watching its AI routine spin up to use every weapon in the game to defeat its enemies. I think I wrote like all kinds of stuff about it. Actually in my notes I wrote, quote, this is a surreal Austin Walker-ass story.
Yes.
And so, you know, hopefully y'all feel that that was a surreal Austin Walker-ass story. But yeah, it was, we get to Rivet City. And he goes in there and he's like, all right, well, do you want to come with me to, you know, wherever, to Project Purity? And I was like, no, I don't think I want to. I think I'll meet you there. I will see you there, Dad. I'm not going to walk across the wasteland with you this time, even though it's only 200 yards. And that's where I dropped it.
Yeah, Eleanor just like watched him like run off into the sunset. He was actually running away from me, like, before I opened the vault. Like, that was that's why I was like, oh, I guess I just thought that he had, like, bugged and was just going to leave. So, yeah, like, I left the garage and just quit the game.
No, he has, you know, a sixth sense for where weapons are. And that's what he was doing. He was going to armor up before killing a herd of Brahmin, which I don't believe were hostile.
No,
before he began killing them,
not.
Which was even weirder. Yeah. Well, that's the end of this episode. Michael, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter at WarrenIsDead.
You can find out everything that we're up to at RangedTouch.com, on Twitter at RangedTouch, and on Patreon, patreon.com/RangedTouch. Where if you want to listen to this as a podcast rather than as a YouTube video, you can back us at $3 a month. You can do that. $5 a month gets you access to the special monthly podcast and the Just King Things bonus episodes. You can listen to our other shows like Just King Things, where we are reading through all the works of Stephen King in publication order. And Game Study Study Buddies, where we read important or interesting or books we like. in the field of game studies and then kind of talk through them and make them, you know, readable and understandable for regular folks like you and me and Liam Neeson. Now, Michael, do you think Liam Neeson listens to Game Study Study Buddies?
Oh, gosh, I do so hope.
Me too. He's got a particular set of skills, but unfortunately, understanding complicated academic books of game studies is not one of them. And that's why he needs us. What's the catchphrase?
War never changes, but Fallout sure does. Everything changed when the boss fell, except for